All right, hello. Welcome to episode null of Welcome to Your Carlson Ears podcast. And this is Virata. I've got James here with me. And very, very special guest on the podcast occasionally. We got Chet Sellers.
How you doing, man? Pleasure to be here.
Good, good.
Love the show.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
It's been a minute. We've had some recent episodes with James and Luke Paristi who might... You know, you might hear a gong and then his sudden appearance might take place at some point during the recording, but we don't know.
So there's a new fighter might enter the tournament.
Yeah. He's kind of like Candyman.
Yeah. If you go in the bathroom and look in the mirror and say the name Luke Paristi three times, he appears behind you and stabs
playing
you.
A harpsichord.
So we got a lot to talk about right now. It is February 1st. Happy Black History Month, guys. We got to talk about free agent stuff. We're about 4 weeks out from the trade deadline. Saw a hilarious tweet from somebody whose life is hockey saying, we're only 5 weeks out from the trade deadline, and it made me immediately feel exhausted.
Yeah, it's so, like a threat.
So, we're 5 weeks out from a day on which almost nothing happens, but we should talk about free agent stuff because the Sens have quite a few, and I'm not sure if you guys have heard the Sens are rebuilding. So it might be an opportunity for some picks, much debated whether or not they're rebuilding, but I'm pretty sure when you trade Erik Karlsson and Mark Stone, you're rebuilding.
Yeah.
That's a thing that you are doing.
Yeah, I just want to say before we get into it, quick shout out to all my dead homies, the San Jose Sharks. Rest in power, my Kings. You know, if you're feeling down because, you know, life is one crushing defeat after another until you just wish Flanders was dead, take a trip down to the Cap Friendly page for the San Jose Sharks. Pass go, collect $200. It's a real psychedelic rock ride, that thing.
You know, it's funny because I can't imagine what it would be like to go into a season expecting to contend, even having made some kind of big acquisitions, in a year that you don't have your first round pick, and watch the bottom completely fall out of your team. Like, I can't imagine how horrible that would be. It certainly wouldn't drive you away from following the team for a couple of years while everything else around the team went wrong and you had to walk into the ocean. So best of luck, San Jose Shark fans.
Yeah, there was some interesting debate back in the 1970s when Dorion traded for Matt Duchene, where I was like, why is he doing this? He's, you know, wasting our pick and stuff, which is, you know, valid conversation. But they had just made the conference finals, you know, the year before. And it was sort of like, we're going to really go for it, I guess, was his mentality. And they weren't a complete dumpster fire yet. I mean, I guess the event that kicked that off was that Sweden trip where Matt Duchene played his first games, which maybe that guy's like a monkey's paw. That's a conversation for another time. But it seems to me like San Jose did the like version of that on steroids. Like they're just like acquiring all the available players and somehow are a lotto team. Like, it's one thing to get Matt Duchene. It's another thing to get, like, Karlsson and add him to your defensive, you know, Mark-Edward Vlasic and Brent Burns and Vander Kane and all these guys locked up. Jeez, I don't know. I don't know how you unfuck this.
Yeah, I'm really surprised that – and we won't spend too much time making this a San Jose Sharks podcast, but
I got plenty of material.
I don't know if you saw the other day. So Tomas Hertl, who's one of their good young players, he's out for the season now with an ACL, MCL injury. So I kind of feel for them in the sense that once you fire your like highly regarded coach and you bring in someone else and then you continue to stink. I don't know, like, if they would go so far as to fire Doug Wilson, who's like one of the largest, longest serving GMs in the league. But, you know, making Erik Karlsson the highest paid defenseman in the entire league and immediately becoming a lottery team is, you know, you got to think that they're in full on panic mode at this point. And it's wonderful to see.
I was talking to a friend about that, and it's like, I liked the numbers on how long Doug Wilson has been the GM of that team. Like, was he like a player GM? Like, he's still playing for the franchise when he became GM? It feels that long. And I kind of wonder, like, the San Jose Sharks, you know, they've been labeled chokers, but he has had a lot of consistency in San Jose. But I wonder, like, should GMs kind of have a shelf life like coaches do? You know, like, you see coaches get fired even after winning cups. Like, a good example would be like Dan Bielsma in Pittsburgh or whatever. It's like, if you have a GM for like over a decade, it's almost like if the team does pretty well, they're kind of just bound to start feeling themselves and fuck up after a while. You know, like, I think you kind of need to put in someone who wants to prove themselves a little bit after a while. I don't know.
Yeah, Wilson was, he does have like longstanding San Jose roots. Like, he was traded to the Sharks from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And at that point he won a Norris Trophy in the early 80s. So he's, you know, he kind of brought credibility to a team that was just as much of a gong show as the Senators in those early expansion years. I think he was a fan favorite for those reasons, but I just looked it up. He's been GM there for 17 years.
Like, that just seems stupid to have somebody do that job for that long. Like,
yeah, I mean, the Sens had Brian Murray in one capacity or another for like how many years? Like 12?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Which, yeah. I feel like we should also take a moment here to recognize that Doug Wilson was on the Ottawa 67s.
Yeah, he's from Ottawa.
Yeah. Yeah, which I'm not going to act like I knew before I just looked it up right now.
He did not wear a fucking helmet his whole career. I still cannot get over that. Like, that guy in the league when Al MacInnis played and would – he's a defenseman, right? Like,
yeah,
he played defense, like, put the puck through the net, and he had no helmet on.
Okay, so best of luck to the San Jose Sharks. I'm sorry that you chose the wrong chalice and you're now disintegrating into a corpse in front of our eyes, but
rest in piss.
Yeah, it's we understand how you feel. Okay, so let's talk about free agents.
Yeah.
James, you wanted to talk about we've got some stuff on the burner here. How are you feeling about it?
We got the J.D. Power and Associates shortlist for FAs for the Sens. I think it's a good time to talk about this. This is why I got into the game when I was a lad, was, you know, free agents and the trade deadline. I'm going to go through the names, I guess, and see what sticks out to you. Like, do you think we could move some of these players? What can we get for them? Do you want to keep anybody?
I feel like there's maybe a juicy disagreement between you and I when it comes to Peugeot, but I'll see where it goes.
Yeah, that's the crown jewel. But there's some, we got Bodker coming up.
Okay, I forgot.
Yeah,
totally forgot.
Area man, human man, Mikhail Bodker, Nemesnikov, mm-hmm. Ennis. Sabarin is an RFA at the end of the year. Ron Hainsey, Dylan DeMello, and Cody Bulgogi Beef, who is 30, by the way. Mark Borowiecki, Greg Anderton, and yes, our crown jewel of our available players, Jean-Gabriel Pageau, actual area man. Is there anyone out of there who you would keep? I can start things off. I feel like I might keep Mark Borowiecki at this point.
Like, I feel like a bit of a convert, actually. You know, I can't remember her last name, Haley, who writes for The Athletic. She writes about the Sens. She had a good piece on Borowiecki, I think, this week, about how he's just like, this is a difficult position for him to be in, how much he loves the community, everything he's done for the Sens. I mean, he's just straight up humiliated himself for Eugene Melnyk.
Yes.
So considering what it costs to keep him and what you could get in return, I'd be completely fine with the Senators re-signing him as like a 6-7 defenseman. Like it.
Well, and I've only watched like half of one game this year, so I'm really going to lean into my ignorance on this. But is he aside from being like the team guy and nail gun and whatever they call him, and being, you know, sort of the de facto, you know, leader on defense or even on the whole team, he's like better now, isn't he? Like empirically.
Yeah. Yeah,
like, isn't that a thing too? Like, isn't he cheap, well-liked, and actually not terrible?
He's having a career season. He's got 17 points, and 6 of those points are goals. And he's a plus one for what it's worth. Like, on a team like this, this no shade lemonade over here, like, Thomas Chabot is a minus 20, and you're kind of like, there but for the grace of God go I. Like, I don't know. Like the other night, he blocked 2 shots while the former NHL team Buffalo Sabres had an empty net and banked it off the boards and it went in. It's just like a perfect metaphor for Mark Borowiecki this year, like just getting absolutely physically punished and kind of putting up points somehow in the process.
He's also, yeah. he's playing 18 minutes a night.
Yeah.
Like, and they don't have him out there as sort of replacement level, like go out there and just try to not get scored on while these guys catch their breath. Like, he's actually playing top 4 minutes.
Yeah. And, you know, it's nice to see him put up a few points for what it's worth. But even despite having a career season at age 30, I kind of look at, like, he's kind of got that. I was always totally perplexed by the contracts that Chris Phillips would get, that he would negotiate himself, by the way, like, and he would get like a year more than you'd think, or $1 million more, $500,000 more than you'd expect, and you'd be like, is there a player with less bargaining power than this guy? Like, he has a fucking restaurant in town. Get bamboozled by this guy. And I look at Borowiecki as kind of like, we know you love it here. We know even if you go to, you know, whatever team for a few months, you're moving back here. I think he can be had for cheap. Term is probably pretty controllable and has that, like, maybe like interim captain vibes, like even in an unofficial capacity, just like team dad. And I don't think you'd get anything for him.
Well, you won't. You won't get really anything for him. And, I mean, Mark Borowiecki, I like the Chris Phillips contract comparison, because you saying that, I just brought back the muscle memory of going on 20-minute rants about Chris Phillips. Mark Borowiecki has never made more than $1.2 million in a season.
Exactly.
So that's not even, like, Chris Phillips money. And, like, he's going to sign for, what, like, 2 years at 4 or something like that? Like, $2 million a year times 2. It's unless you think he's going to be like significantly blocking someone else from being the 6th or 7th defenseman. Like, I don't, what are we talking about here? Yeah. And I mean, Borowiecki's not going to play as long as Chris Phillips did, right? Like, he's going to be, you know, around for a couple of years, but, like, you know, Mark Methot just retired. Like, it's not an easy position to play. No. Like, he's going to be around for a couple of years, and he will bridge the gap to kind of whatever's next, and he will be somebody that people on the team like. And I'm not arguing that it's like a chemistry thing or anything like that. I just think it's, if he's decent and he's, you know, fills a role and he's, you know, cheap, then, and he's local, and he will literally eat shit for the team whenever he's asked to do it.
He almost lost his eye, like, last week. I feel like he's earned a juicy $2 million contract at this point.
He almost lost his eye, and you'll still have people being like, Borowiecki, shave those sideburns, you know? Like,
also, for what it's worth, I think he and his wife just had a baby. So it might just be the decent thing to do to keep him around, at least to the end of the season.
Mazel. Okay, so I love the Borowiecki glow up. We're all just like, yeah, he's a good guy. Like, we were ready to kill this guy a couple of years ago. I just kind of think of, like, I don't know if it landed, but, like, I rattled off pretty much all the free agents, and we skip over, like, Namestnikov, who I think is a pretty effective player, and Tyler Ennis, who's having a great season.
Yeah.
I think he has as many points as Tkachuk has. And we're just like, no, gotta keep Borowiecki for the culture, though.
Well, so about all those guys, about like Nemestikov, Ennis, I think Hainsey is in there. These are guys that by the end of the season, there's not a lot of money left to be paid out on their contracts. Mm-hmm. None of them are like world beaters. They're all kind of depth. You know, Ennis has proven that given minutes on a bad team and a lot of power play time, he can definitely put up some goals.
Yeah.
But I mean, how are you guys feeling about, you know, my sense of it is that for all of them, you're maybe getting some mid-round picks.
Some kind of like Jonathan Davidson type prospect guy, you know, like maybe they'll be something, but maybe
well, I think you could get something for Peugeot, right? Like, I think he's the one guy who, like, if Peugeot becomes like your third line center on a cup contender team, like mm-hmm. if he's like your Derek Brassard of the playoffs or something like that, then that's probably worth something.
Yeah, so last night, sorry if I can just jump around here. There was a thing going around on Twitter, like everyone making, just everyone sort of calling where they think everyone's going to land. And I don't want to blow up our sequence here, but if you don't mind, my call on this, my guess, and I think Matt Bosty put a rotisserie chicken on the line for this, is I think Ennis goes to a team like the Islanders. Who don't have a lot of money to throw around. You know, he's effective and high value. I think they go as high as maybe like offering a third or something like that, maybe even a second, because they miss out on the more expensive players. But, you know, the Islanders are one of those teams that are just like really, you know, they were good last year. They're good this year. They should be adding at the deadline.
If you told me Tyler Ennis played for the Islanders now, I'd believe you.
Yeah, I was going to say, he seems like he's already on the Islanders to me.
Like, I don't think I even know what he looks like.
Boro, I think he stays in Ottawa. I actually think what I would like to see for Anderson is he goes to the Panthers, because I know he's a Florida guy, and he's got his like second VR driving rig down there already.
Yeah,
they spent all this money on goaltending, but Bobrovsky's not looking incredible. You know, for Anderson's sake, I'd like for him to spend his like early slushy spring in Florida.
I am not optimistic about getting jack shit for Andy. Like, I love
Thank
the guy,
you.
But he, like, I do not know what like a 38-year-old goaltender with a sub 900 save percentage who's like been hurt this year already like gets you. Like, I could see that being like a really depressing trade.
Yeah, like you can be an old goalie, like you can be, I don't know, Dwayne Roloson or something like that. It happens. And, you know, we always were like, oh, he's going to age well because he didn't play a lot when he was young. And it's like, yeah, that's true. But he's also, what, is he 38 or 39 at this point, something like that?
He's, as far as I go, yeah, like he'll turn 39 on a playoff team.
Yeah, so put it this way. You can be an old goalie, but it's hard for me to say that you can be an effective old goalie after you've been bad for, let's be honest, a couple of years now.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Unless, I mean, maybe there's a team that's like, you know what, we think this guy's going to get hot in the playoffs, and good luck to him, and I hope he does. Yeah. But I don't see anybody taking Craig Anderson. I see him hanging around, and I'd rather have him like go somewhere else next year or retire than trade him the best goalie in franchise history for like a sixth round pick.
Yeah.
How wild is it to look back on the idea that Brian Elliott and Craig Anderson were traded one for one and both ended up turning their careers around somewhere else? Like, it's nobody knows anything when it comes to goalies. No. Although I will say, if you're 38 and you've been terrible for a couple of years, you're probably not going to turn it around.
So, like, Andy, thing he has going for him, if he wants to, you know, try get his shot at the playoffs this year in the twilight of his career, is that, like clockwork, some team has goalie drama at the perfect time, whether it's an injury or just someone flailing around like brain geniuses at in Florida City, Florida, who signed Sergei Bobrovsky for like $100 billion. He's got a chance to go somewhere, but
Well, I mean, I suppose, and again, I know nothing about goaltending, and I suppose that, you know, you could talk yourself into he's a big game guy.
Yeah,
and he's been on terrible teams. He's got the, you know, the league's worst or second worst defense in front of him. So, I mean, maybe if you're somebody who knows these things, you look at the video and you're like, oh no, he still boxes out the post and moves high low and stacks his pads the right way, and he's still got that reaction time. I don't know. Maybe that's the way you talk yourself into it, but
That's what I was going to say is, like, we know Craig Anderson very well as a player at this point. And, like, if some, you know, good team out there needs some insurance for goaltending come the playoffs and he gets a start or two, like, I think they're going to get a good Craig Anderson performance. You know, like, he's never really, like, shit the bed during the playoffs for us. I think he's had his moments, but, you know, best goaltender we've ever had. Like, I think, and you could have him for a song. I think like a fifth round pick or something is what I'm expecting for.
Yeah. And I mean, you know what? He could go on a run in the spring because he will be traded somewhere and he's living in a hotel in Raleigh, Durham or something like that. And there's nothing to do except think about goaltending and be good at it. But like I said, I mean, I don't watch the games. I don't even know where they play. So he may still have, you know, the skills, and some goaltending coach is watching him on the video and he's like, you see that kid's right there. That's how you do it right there. But
no, certainly hope no one is scouting Craig Anderson. They want to trade for him. It's not a good, like, I hope they look at his YouTube highlight reel from like that year in Colorado when he was like putting up 50 saves a game.
Yeah.
One conspicuous omission from your list of upcoming free agents, James, which a particularly juicy one too.
Mm.
The Duke.
Well, he's an RFA though. I think he gets re-signed.
He's not going anywhere. They're going to Mike Hoffman him every year.
Yeah.
You think he goes to arbitration?
I would say probably, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk about our firstborn son in the room. We have had a little bit of a tête-à-tête on Twitter, but talking about Jean-Gabriel Pagiot. And I want to say, I don't know, I wanted to hear what you had to say about the list of possible destinations for players. And I think I've seen Pagiot tied to Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And you know those machines, like after your street gets the snow plowed off and it makes giant snowbanks, and then they eventually put the no parking signs on, and then this big like thresher machine, I call it like brushing the street's teeth, like it eventually gets all the like giant snowbanks off of the curb between, you know, the road and the sidewalk. If Jean-Gabriel Pagiot gets traded to Pittsburgh, I will throw myself into one of those. Like, thank God for the sweet release of death. I will not be able to look at that. My own son in the Pittsburgh Penguins uniform.
Oh. Yeah, I don't know if he goes to Pittsburgh because, I mean, he's one of the more sought after players this trade deadline. We've heard, you know, it's been circulated that the Sens want at least a first round pick for him, maybe even more than that. If you're a team like the Penguins, where you're going to play him at most as a third line center.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing I think we often forget is that the Penguins traded for Alex Galchenyuk, and he's their. So like, and I know he's having a terrible season and maybe they're going to try and get rid of him, but like, so where are you playing Pagiot if you have to pay a first rounder for a rental? I was actually looking at, and I haven't heard anything about this being the case, but I was looking at Tampa. I know that he'd have to play behind Steven Stamkos and Braden Point. But after that, they've got like this kind of rotating cast of third and fourth line centers. And, you know, I know they like to use Stamkos like as a center and on the wing sometimes. So, I think it gives them a lot more flexibility. I just think it maybe makes sense for them. I don't know whether Ottawa trades him in division as well. That feels kind of unlikely, given that we built into the Carlson deal that San Jose would have to give up an entire additional first round pick if he ends up getting traded back to the Eastern Conference.
Oh yeah. yo, that train, it's just got layers. It's like an infinite jest of trains.
I would have no problem trading him in division if it meant he still got to play the Habs like five times a year.
That's good for us in the division. Yeah.
No, it's
like five losses a year.
I like Pageau. I would trade him for a first round pick or more if possible, because the closest parallel to me is the trade of Mike Fisher, I would say. Like, yeah. I don't know if they're similar age, but they traded him to Nashville for first. And he was what, like the second or third line center at the time? It was probably like the third line center for a couple of years at least when they still had Spezza and they were really good.
Yeah.
But I could, and everybody was like, yeah, you know, it sucks and we all like Mike Fisher, but it's also kind of time and we are going through this rebuild and it doesn't make a lot of sense. Like Pageau, if he's your third line center, you like, it's fantastic. Like you're a good team. If Pageau is like your first line center, then it's not great. Right. So I would probably, and I wouldn't keep him and pay him, you know, to be a third line center for another 5 years, given what he's probably going to cost. I would probably rather, like, for all the forwards, with the exception of Duclair, I would just, like, that's where you've got people on the way, right? So I would basically just start getting, like, Logan Brown in there, get Josh Norris in there. And even if they're terrible, you've got Mark Borbietsky providing veteran leadership on defense. And,
yeah. You know, like, that's.
Like, they've got a higher ceiling. So, like, I like Pageau, but he's kind of, this is as good as it's going to get for Pageau. And he's not going to be, like, he shouldn't be the highest paid player on the team or close to.
I did a little fun thing the other day, and to what you're saying about the center depth is, I made an entire team out of, because I'm normal and have a really healthy relationship with hockey. I made an entire lineup out of players that are under 25 years old, and like Philip Schlappick is like the fourth line center on my team. Like you have White, Brown, Norris ahead of him, you know, or you can move those parts around, but we're potentially going into a draft where we could have like two top five picks, and you'd think at least one of those would probably be a center. So like, thank you for your immaculate and legendary service to the community, Jean-Gabriel Pageau, but like, yeah, some of these guys, we're gonna have to see what we have in them at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I think I go back and forth on this a little bit too. Like I was I always thought of Pageau as like an extremely, extremely good middle six center. Mm-hmm. And those are guys you absolutely 1,000% need. And if you develop them yourself and they have hometown loyalty and all that, all the better. Like he's exactly the type of guy you want if you're competing.
Yeah.
And the Sens are not going to be good for at least another few years. So, and he's turning 30. So basically you're paying him at his peak and presumably you're paying him peak dollars to give you very good value and maybe elevate you from like 29th in the league to 27th or something.
Yeah.
Like it just doesn't feel like, it reminds me of when like Toronto was paying Phil Kessel to put up 40 plus goals and they would suck. And you just be like, well, why would you give up lottery picks and pay him millions of dollars if you're not competing for an actual Stanley Cup? So as much as I hate to see him go, what's that, sir?
It's because they're cursed and stupid.
Right. Yeah. So I hate to see him go because he's delivered like some of the all time best Ottawa Senators moments which is like so valuable. And if they re-signed him, you know, if come trade deadline, they're like, you know what? We got offered a third round pick. Then like, okay, like re-sign him. Like no one's going to be upset if they re-sign them. But if there's an actual first-round pick on the table, then I feel like they got to do it.
I've read that Edmonton's balking on their first-round pick offer for him, which is not great news.
The other thing I'll say about Pageau is that, like, we love him, but it wouldn't be heartbreaking to trade him the way that it was. It would either be heartbreaking to lose a player that had, you know, that you wanted to keep and had been with the team his entire career, or a guy who was so clearly the best in the league at his position and would have stayed under other circumstances. Like Pageau, to me, not to sound too unsentimental, but we've had the good moments with him. We've seen him kind of, if not his peak, then close to. Yeah. And like for him to go, like, it's sort of a clean break to go now when the team is bad. And especially if you like the guy, like, you don't necessarily want to watch him kind of have to lead this team through the next 2 or 3 years and, you know, lose 60 games a year, not 60, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, I mean, if he goes to, I don't know, some Western Conference team and he plays another 5 years at a high level there, like, good for him. Like, I wouldn't be too upset about it. I do think the quicker way for this team to start, you know, getting better is to, you know, I mean, Peugeot will provide some consistency, but I think you get those guys in the lineup now and, you know, just kind of let them go.
Plus, he's getting his big contract of his career this year. And like I said, you get into this situation where you have, you know, White, Brown, Norris, Schlappick, God, like that Shane Pinto kid is in the mix now. And
Batherson.
And no, I'm just talking about at center.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And then it's like, we're going to draft, like, this draft has 11 picks. And like 2 to 3 of them could be in the top or in the first round. You're probably, like, someone's going to come out of the woodwork. And I'd hate for Peugeot to sort of be this albatross taking someone's place, like, oh shit, we had to sign him for like 5 years because memories and like, you know, cultural significance, when, you know, yeah, there's a lot of centers and we're only going to probably take on more this coming draft.
I feel like,
yeah, Peugeot is going to be looking to get paid and he should. So yeah. I just don't think that we need to, like, whatever benefit he's going to provide over the next 5 years. Like, I think, you know, it will be, we'll be better off, you know, getting those guys in at center, as you say.
I feel like something that is happening under the surface here is that the Sens, knowing they're going to be bad, are playing a style of hockey that is pretty entertaining. A lot of guys that normally wouldn't get ice time are getting tons of ice time.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that surprising that like a bunch of pending free agents are getting like key power play time and are having career seasons. I think a lot of that is on purpose to try and sort of pump up their value a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, Peugeot's this like perfect example of this, where on a deeper team, he wouldn't be getting, you know, his average, he's playing almost 20 minutes a night, which is 2 minutes a night more than he normally gets in his entire career. You know, he's shooting 18%, which is ridiculous. I see on Twitter when Sens are outperforming expectations, it kind of like, are the Sens like kind of nice with it? Like moments? And it's like, I feel like it's important we remember that they're not. they're like a bad team.
You know, two wins in 2020. Are the Sens too good?
Like they're a bad rebuilding team, and like veteran players on affordable deals are getting really good ice time, and good for them. You know, I think it's not a surprise that like spirits are high in the dressing room, even though the team is bad. You know, like players are getting really good looks.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of those guys know that they're going to contenders in the next year. And it's, you know, I was reading about it, like Peugeot hasn't even been offered a contract yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think the writing's on the wall that he's going somewhere.
Yeah. You kind of reminded me of this. This is my most Coke Dreams thing I have going for me, at least like outside of my clothing line. It's called Head, Heart, and Hustle. That's probably a real clothing line, actually. Is I made up a team called, like when you said that the Sens are probably going to be bad for another few years or whatever. I don't disagree with that.
I don't think they're actually that far away. Like of finishing eighth in the East, I think I can see it being 2 years.
So this kind of ties into the FA thing where I looked at the FAs, like Ron Hainsey, and even like, you know, I think maybe one of the most tempting guys to keep is Dylan DeMello, maybe, you know, but I don't even know how much term I'd want to give that guy. But I built this team called the Under 25 Urban Achievers. It's a team made up entirely of just prospects. And aside from a couple of positions, like right wing a little bit and right defense is kind of nascent still, it's kind of low-key sexy with it. You want, is it weird to just like rattle off the lineup that I made? Maybe if you're like on the O train right now, you could like tag this on the seat in front of you. But so this is like all players that are under 25, I put together, and I know Duclair is kind of a left winger, but he's got an insane shot from the right side, kind of like Hoffman did. But it goes Tkachuk, White, Duclair, Formenton, Brown, Batherson, Balsters, Norris, Abramov, Paul, Schlappick, and then like Davidson or Verno. Admittedly, the Paul Schlappick Davidson line is a little bit like whatevs, but also it's a fourth line of like only prospects. Mm-hmm. Then on defense, the pairings would be, and it gets a little, like I said, it gets a little weaker on the right side because some of these guys are like 19 or like 18, not even like on the Belleville sends yet, but is Shabbat, Yaros, Brandstrom, Bernard Docker, and then like maybe Lejoie, or remember this guy, Christian Wolinen, and then like Nucky Thompson, the new guy. In net, Decord, who is putting together an insanely good season, by the way. Mm-hmm. Gustafsson, and then Hogberg is not under 25 anymore, so he's not in this mix.
What about the giant Danish guy?
Yeah, Mads Sogaard is like, now we're getting into like third string goalie. And then that, like, so that's an entire team of under 25 prospects, like pretty decent. And like I said, we're about to have a draft where they're going to pick 11. They currently have 11 picks and they haven't even traded off any of those pending free agent guys. Like it's not perfect. Like it definitely lacks on the right wing, right defense. The guys are a little like early to tell, like Lassie Thompson is in the Finnish league right now. And Bernard Docker is still in college. Yaros, I don't know what his ceiling is or if he's reached it, but yeah, they're going to add at least 11 picks this year. I'm kind of like, wow, we're like a couple like players really working out away from having like a pretty respectable team made entirely of guys under 25 years old.
And you know, in that theme, Sens have 3 second rounders this year. Yeah. How would you guys feel if the Sens packaged 2 or possibly all 3 of those to move up into the first round? You know, given that, you know, that's a pretty deep lineup you just read off. But what it does lack is like super, super high-end blue chip talent, like outside of maybe like Tkachuk and Brandstrom and Shabbat. So
I wouldn't, just because those second rounders, like there's sort of a really steep drop off from like the top 5 in terms of skill, right? Mm-hmm. So unless you could trade 3 second rounders for like a top 5 pick, and I don't think a lot of teams would do that. Yeah. Like once you get to like 15, like the 15th round pick or the 15th overall down to like the 45th or 50, like that's a very low spread of talent or expected career performance. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'd rather have like 3 lottery tickets instead of 1.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I wonder about this. Like it feels like we're hitting on all of our long shot prospects.
Sorry.
Sorry. Go on.
Oh no. It's going to be in my book.
titled "Misunderstood."
Got to hear both sides. I think you bring up a good point. Like when you make up an entire lineup of like where the second line is like Formenton, Brown, Batherson. That's pretty nice, like that. Like Balsers, maybe you could swap in for Formenton, but like it's starting to get like a full house. And I'm thinking to myself, especially with the emergence, it's early to tell, but like Josh Norris looking high key sexy with it makes me think like maybe we should package up Logan Brown with like a pick to, you know, really swing for the fence, and instead of having Colin White as our first line center, theoretically, like try to draft Quinton Byfield or something, like really try to, like you said, get that game changer center for Tkachuk and Batherson or Duclair, mm-hmm. you know, and really move this thing along. like when you think about it, the pressure is not even on Brännström to grow into a top pairing defenseman. Like he's probably not going to leapfrog Shabbat. That's amazing.
Yeah. And I mean, not all those guys are going to hit, right? Like, no. And even, you know, for some of them, like, I mean, Josh Norris, this is what, his first pro season, and he's like really good right away. Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah, as they say, you love to see it. Because you kind of look at Logan Brown and they're like, oh, well, he's really tall and he's going to take more time and his game is raw and all of that. And that's all of that is totally true. But when you're sort of like, oh, but Josh Norris is really good right away. Like,
he's got a new hat.
You know, you sort of think like, and especially as you say, if you have like 11 picks on the way and two potentially in the top five, like, yeah, at a certain point you say, you know what, there's some potential here. We know they're not all going to work out. So, you know, maybe you can shuffle that a little bit. But I think you've talked yourself out of keeping Jean-Gabriel Pageau as you go through this exercise.
Looking at, sure, Lafreniere is a winger, but like, let's just fucking get one of those players. Like, we have a lot of like toolsy meat and potatoes. I mean, I think that's honestly being a little modest. Like, players like Fermentin and Balcers and Batherson don't really seem like toolsy guys. They seem like high skill wingers themselves. You know, they're not the next Eric Condra or something. But yeah, it's almost like let's put the icing on the cake phase already. I think you wrote a thing about it, Virata, back during the Doom year, like the complete nihilism phase of the rebuild, where all our beloved babies were going to be sold at the market, and Melnick was like actually like throwing cups of piss at us and stuff, where you were like, you know, the cool thing about this rebuild is we're about to trade off like all our best players for presumably like good returns, like Carlson and Stone and stuff. And they've already kind of built the foundation of Deese, you know, like players you can set your watch to, like Colin White, and you know, Shabbat is signed at this point, and they actually have some goaltending depth. Like, it's not like you're gonna get potentially like the Connor McDavid and then it's like, now what? Or, you know, it's like, the more I look at the depth in the organization ahead of this draft, the more I'm thinking like, oh, we should just be taking all the like swing for the fence. This guy's, you know, an amazing skater, but he's got to put some meat on his bones. Or this defenseman is putting up tons of points, but doesn't have a good two-way game. It's like, who cares? Let's just get all the like Ferrari type players.
Yeah. Because
we have enough Jacob Bernard Docker kind of like guys at this point.
Yeah. I mean, this feels like a good time to transition to, I kind of wanted to talk about how this draft feels like maybe the most consequential moment in the history of like the modern Ottawa Senators. I think that like the point I was making in that post is, you know, when most teams rebuild, they think they're good and then they have a really humbling season and they realize that they should be rebuilding and they end up selling off all their veterans. Maybe they get a high draft pick. This goes back to the years before the draft lottery. And then they get a really good, promising, potentially franchise guy. They throw him in, and he's got nothing to compliment him. So they're just basically like throwing him to the wolves. He's too good to be in the minors, but he has nothing around him in the NHL. And then they spend the next 3-4 years trying desperately to like get from the free agent market or through the trade market. Or they're drafting with like later round picks, which take 3 or 4 years to develop, guys like Pageau or like White or whatever. The Sens, their hands were forced by something different, which was that the owner didn't have any money. So a team that you could conceivably add something to and they would be a contender ended up selling off right in the middle of their building cycle. So that it's like this really rare moment to have a team selling off like Mark Stone in his prime, Eric Carlson in his prime, Pageau in his prime, Duchesne, Zingle, like players that
Craig Anderson in his prime.
He's going to play till he's 45. And so like you have this really rare moment where the Senators just got boatloads of picks. We're seeing in year one of like all those picks together, we've got this really broad, but not this really broad range of like toolsy prospects, but we don't have that big ticket, needle moving blue chip prospect, which brings us to this year where we have two shots at a draft lottery at the top three picks or top four picks. And it happens to be a deep draft. This isn't going to be a year where like the Senators end up with like Aaron Ekblad, who's like a perfectly good top line defenseman, but he's not Connor McDavid.
Yeah.
You know, there are two guys at the top of the draft who could be franchise top 10 players in the league. And Ottawa has two realistic shots at them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know about you guys. I do run the draft lottery simulator about 150 times a day.
Yeah. Normal, healthy.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Ignoring my family, just doing it on my phone. And there are times where you're just like, okay, this would be incredible. And there are times where Sens end up picking like eighth and ninth. And you're like, oh my God. Imagine if we end up with like two Jared Cowans. And that could change. Like, it's the difference between the Senators being the Penguins for the next 20 years and the Senators being, I don't know, like the Minnesota Wild or something, where they're like kind of in the playoffs most of the time. But
If there's one team that the league is going to rig the draft lottery for, it's the Ottawa Senators.
Absolutely. The deep state folks, the globalists. No, but like the things like the draft simulator or like, again, 11 picks as it stands, you know, before the deadline, like, I don't know what we'll end up with, like 15, 16 picks in the draft potentially. And I'm not counting on this happening, but doing these kind of exercises, like looking at what we have already and what we could have, is like the rebuild or whatever you want to call it is like way farther ahead than I kind of realized. It sort of snuck up on me. Say Ottawa got to pick Lafreniere, who's a left wing. Our left wing depth in terms of young players will be, you know, Lafreniere, Tkachuk, Duclair, Formentin, Balcers, and Nick Paul. Like, you're getting like Nick Paul, who is an NHL player, is like your sixth string left winger. Like, that's pretty good depth. Like, maybe I'm a homer, but like Rudolf Balcers and Alex Formentin are like two of the best players in the AHL. They just both played in the AHL All-Star game, and Formentin is a rookie. You know, like Josh Norris is a rookie and he's the leading goal scorer in the league now, I think. Like, there's some pretty decent guys already. You know, not all of them are going to hit, but it's going to get crowded really quickly. And when you talk about like, who should we potentially package up? Those are the kind of decisions I'm glad I don't have to make, because, you know, like you said, Chet, like Josh Norris is good right away. And like Logan Brown, I kind of wonder if he looks like he has a similar skating mechanic to him. As like, oh my God, is Logan Brown a player that we're just never going to be able to love? You know, like, does he have that Jason Spezza, like, puts up like 900 points? It's like, yeah, that defensive game though. You know? Like, is he that kind of guy? But could we potentially trade him away and get burned for it for the next, you know, decade and a half or whatever?
Well, and ask yourself how many upper-class kids from St. Louis your team really needs, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, all these guys have some pretty bad politics. So I'd like to feel a little bit better by having some guy from, like, rural Quebec.
Yeah, rural
where the
Quebec.
Politics Home are perfect.
Tremendous politics.
Yeah, I feel like every time we look at those prospect rankings, like the team rankings, generally it's like the top five is like the teams that picked top five in the last year's draft. You know, it's like the team that drafted first overall has one of the best prospect systems in the league.
New Jersey Devils right there though.
and there's a lot of you know, I find a lot of the assessment of Ottawa's prospect pool is like people who look at hundreds of prospects but don't follow just Sens prospects tend to be like, we have all of these guys projected to be third line centers.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, well, I, you know, maybe I have no idea.
That's kind of like
there's like a huge premium placed on like top line talent. And Ottawa, you know, I love Brady Tkachuk. I don't know if he's like, you know, going to be a guy who puts up 100 points one year or something. You know, like, I'm so glad he's on the team instead of Zadina, you know, but, you know, I don't know if he's like a Jack Eichel type.
Yeah, but like, he's probably going to score like 25 goals this year without like an elite center on like one of the worst teams in the league. And he's like 19. Like,
I feel a lot better about Brady Tkachuk just because like he was good as a rookie, but it was also kind of like, yeah, but is he going to, you know, have a sophomore year where he's just not as kind of lucky poking stuff in the crease and cleaning up all the garbage? And that's the one thing about playing Brady Tkachuk's game that I'm realizing is that it's kind of, I don't want to say it like he's not dependent on things like shooting luck, you know, like he's kind of, I think he can kind of consistently do what he's doing and get stronger and taller and, you know, all those other things that weirdly seem to happen when guys who have otherwise gone through puberty join the NHL. So it wouldn't be surprised me to see him kind of just be like a consistent guy, but like a consistent, like 70 or 80 point guy, as opposed to Jason Spezza in his prime, you know?
Yeah. The guy who kind of weirds me out a little bit like that is Colin White, because I think Colin White's a tremendous skater. He plays a very mature kind of game for his age.
He's 47.
Like, yeah, it shows.
he's at home wearing a fisherman's sweater right now.
Yeah, like if I tuned into SportsCenter and saw like him doing a locker room interview and he had wisps of gray hair on his temples, I'd be like, of course, normal 23-year-old stuff. But like, he's the guy that I believe in as a player. Like, I'm not worried that he's not an NHL player, but like, you know, Mark Stone gets traded and like, a bada boom bada bang, my man has like 5 goals this year. Like, you know, like I worry about him maybe being like a third line center, like kind of like the next Pageau. Like, he'll be the heir to Pageau's place as like the extremely reliable, like, maybe steps it up in the playoffs kind of third line center guy. But even
that's exactly what he is.
Yeah, but he's currently like kind of, after Pageau presumably gets traded, he's kind of the heir apparent to like first line center. And I'm like, I don't know if I see that. So Colin White kind of gets me thinking, like, are we packaging people up for that like true first line center, which this team, I don't know what Brown's ceiling is. I'm really confused as to what that guy is going to end up being. But I'm feeling like maybe Josh Norris has that kind of sauce. But I think we want to hedge our bets and have like a few guys that might be, like you're saying, Brad, at like 100 points, you know.
Brown is confusing because he's one of these guys who's so dominant in the AHL.
Yeah.
And then you bring him up to the NHL and he, you know, he hasn't looked bad, but like you imagine that there are times where he's, I mean, we're throwing him out there as a first top line center. And you know what he reminds me of, not because he's anything like this player, but because of that, like, dominant at the AHL, can't really break in the NHL, is, remember Denis Hamel?
Well, yeah.
Like, he, you know, just absolutely destroying at the AHL level and like almost never even got a cup of coffee in the NHL. And he would come up and like get hit into the rafters by Phaneuf. And then they'd be like, yeah, we're sending you back down.
Well,
man, like, I don't know if he never got a shot or shot, but
I don't want to hit you with the wild actually, but like, that guy had a devastating knee injury and could never skate at the NHL level. So that's why kind of permanently, like, he's like an AHL Hall of Fame captain. Like, you know, similar to that is Jonathan Chichu. Like, you would watch him when he played in Ottawa, just a heartbreaking player. Like, I remember especially, like, live, you'd see, you could watch him on a whole shift and like, he'd be trying, like, you could tell he just had too many sports hernias in his career, and he'd be like skating back to the bench and like doubled over in pain just from playing. He goes down to the AHL eventually and is like an MVP. Like, he still has that, like, Rocket Richard trophy winning shot, but like, the NHL is just too intense for his skating level at this point, you know?
Yeah, but that's just my point, is that a player, for whatever reason, in the AHL reason, could be like so dominant in the AHL and be like, you know, he comes up to the NHL and they'll be like, he doesn't possess the like basic tools you need just to like survive this league.
Yeah, like, you're wondering, is Logan Brown Jason Spezza, or is he the Jason Spezza of the AHL?
Exactly.
Like, because the way he plays, there's really not, you know, like Colin White, I look at his contract and I'm like, well, if he's like a top line center or second line center, great. But if he ends up being a third line center, that contract in a couple of years is going to be like third line center money. It's not really like a disaster or whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Logan Brown, you don't really see that when he play, like, he's this kind of like does a 360 and puts like the puck on some guy who you didn't even know was in the play stick, and like the net's completely open. But it's like, you see it with Brännström too. They are definitely playing to not get sent back down. You know, that's kind of a weird,
yeah,
like, and when they go back down to the AHL, it's like, here's your first unit power play time. Here's like 22 minutes a night, and they get to do their art. Whereas I think they're just trying to like keep those NHL paychecks coming and like not make the coach mad kind of call up still at this point. Some of the positions are so stacked at this point. Like, I feel like, the team, again, like 11 picks in this draft as of today, like maybe we should actually consider that, you know, the left-hand side has Duclair, Tkachuk, Fermentin, Balcerzin. But I feel like some of these guys are starting to be a little superfluous already. You know, like, I don't think we're going to have trouble finding a third or fourth line center. It's about finding the true number one and then maybe just, like, hopefully relying on Josh Norris or Colin White being a second line center.
I completely agree. Like, you want to pick as high as you can and just get as much top line talent as you can and just push everybody down the roster as far as you can. I don't think teams trade top five picks anymore. Like, I think they are, you know that how steep the drop off is after that. Yeah. So, like, Colin White is, you know, his ceiling may be Peugeot third line center, and that's fine. Like, that's not that bad. No, but, no. Like, I think other than, I mean, maybe you trade, like, Logan Brown in a sixth for a fifth, but, like, I don't know who does that, you know? So,
yeah.
To me, it's just...
And he's a top 10 pick himself.
Yeah, you know? To me, just keep tanking, keep running that simulator. I just ran it now, and I got Ottawa 1-2, so I'm going to just basically... Shit. I'm going to leave that there. To Virata's point about, is this the most momentous, you know, draft in Senators history? I don't know that I'd say it's like the most momentous. Like, I would say things like getting a number two pick when you're already good is kind of one of the ways that you can sort of sustain success over the course of an entire decade. But I would say that having 11 picks is probably the biggest deal. Like, for as much as we've dunked on PR Dorion for talking about, like, you know, how many assets they've acquired and pieces and picks, like, 11 picks is a big deal, especially when you've got like six in the top three rounds.
11 picks before the trade deadline. Like, they could have 15 picks easily.
Yeah, like, that's what stocks have covered, right? And that's what, like, you will have guys that will disappoint, but you'll have other ones that will overperform. You'll have a lot of stuff to play with. You'll have prospects you can trade. Like, to me, that's when you start getting into the, okay, how do we kind of rationalize everything we have and sort of, you know, start doing 3-for-1 swaps and stuff like that. It's probably the year after this one. Go ahead.
Just to build on your point, like, the draft that I've been thinking about the most is the 2011 draft, because that's the last time we were in this position, right? Like, there were, I believe there were 10 picks total that year, three in the top, three in the first round. All praise due, like, you gotta take your fedora off to the Sens on this one, is that I think only two out of those 10 picks didn't play in the NHL. Like, if you look at on HockeyDB, if you look at that draft where they group the draft class in, like, everyone's got NHL stats except for Darren Kramer, who got arrested at Disney World, I think, and Jordan Franzou. But the reason I've been thinking about this draft so much is that I remember that draft. I knew like the top 30 players, you know, and I was very excited. Like, they had the lotto pick, which was Zibanejad. Matt Pumple was kind of one of those, like, this guy could be the next, like, Joe Sakic, but he had hip surgery. So, you know, kind of a swing for the fence, like, high, the kind of guy you want to take in the late first round. Mm-hmm. Stephen Nason looked like the sort of safe, like, two-way set your watch, like, penalty-killing dude that you need. But when the dust settled on that draft...
Fourth rounder.
Exactly. The best players, the players who came out of that draft, which was very successful, who played over 300 games, is Zibanejad at the top six, or in the top six, Pageau in the fourth round, almost at 100th overall, and Ryan Dezingle, who was the last player picked, I think, seventh round, who is definitely, like, who didn't we get a... We got Anthony Duclair for him last year, and a pick, like
two second round picks.
Like, he was a, so it kind of gets me thinking about this draft is like, if they have 11 plus picks, is like probably going to get at least one good player out of the two, you know, our pick and San Jose's pick. And then after that, it's like probably going to find that. I mean, if the Sens are good at anything, it's like finding a Mike Hoffman or a Ryan Dezingle, or like, in the later rounds, you know, like those are,
I mean, I had a moment of real appreciation for Dorian the other day, actually, when he was talking about, he was being interviewed by someone about this year's draft. And if I were in his position, I would immediately have like a freak out on camera about how we like absolutely need to win the draft lottery. And I actually feel like he's extremely even keel about the draft, being a former scout and a former like head scout. He immediately started talking about how underappreciated their third round pick is. Like, it's going to be a high third rounder.
Oh, and, I see.
You know, he's like really good at being like, no matter where we land, we're going to get good players. Like, I think his view of the development process is like, yeah, of course, if you draft first or second overall, you're going to get a star. Like, anybody can do that. And that's yep. why like no one goes off the board in the top three. It's the stuff you do later in later rounds that really matter. And he's like, you know, we got the 3 second rounders, and remember, we have a high third as well. And you're like, who the fuck is thinking about a high third when you have two lottery picks?
Yeah.
And I really appreciated that, actually. Like, he's a guy who's like really intent on producing NHL players, which is harder than being like, I drafted top three and I ended up with an NHL player. Like, he's looking for those guys who can actually end up on the NHL roster in the third round.
Well, that's the zhuzh that Pierre Dorion has, you know, that you have to give him credit for. A great example is the 2017 draft, where Ottawa only had, I think, like 4 or 5 picks. And their first round pick that year was Shane Bowers, who was like, remember that guy? Mm-hmm. And then the two middle picks in the second and fourth round are Alex Fermentin and Drake Batherson, who are both like, you know, I mean, Drake Batherson is like vying for like an AHL MVP if he didn't get called up to the NHL, which is a very good problem to have. And Alex Fermentin is like the rookie goal scoring leader, who I think he just put up, they did the AHL skills competition, which is a thing I know about because, again, just a tremendously healthy relationship to professional hockey. I'm very normal. Is that his lap that he skated in the fastest skater was like a tenth of a second behind like Connor McDavid's. Like, mm-hmm, these are the kind of guys that Pierre Dorion is finding outside of the first round. And that's why I brought up the 2011 draft. Is like, of course, yes, Mika Zibanejad is a good player. But like, Matt Pumple and Stephen Nason are kind of forgettable players. But that was such a big deal that year. That's all I was focused on. Like, oh my God, we have 3 first round picks, you know? Whereas the actual useful players came out of the fourth round and the seventh round.
Yeah, I was really excited about that draft too, especially because other than Chris Phillips, they really cleared the decks, right? And it wasn't a situation where they're like, oh, why are they rebuilding? It was at that point in the cycle where you're like, yeah, they obviously do actually need to do this now. And I think, you know, people bought into the idea that they needed to rebuild. Nobody was kind of as toxic on the team as they are right, you know, have been for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. Of course, there was a lot we didn't know then either. But the problem with that year was they had all those picks and they picked those three guys in the first round, and Zibanejad looked like he was going to be pretty good, although I think he went back to Sweden that first year. And then what did they do? They made the playoffs, right? Like right away. That was the point where they just said, oh, okay, let's just figure this out so that we can just kind of keep pushing stuff forward and finish seventh or eighth in the East every year. And that was basically another 7 or 8 years of that, and to get us where we are now. So what I am hoping is that they pick these 11 guys and they kind of keep on this track for at least one more year in terms of having a base of, you know, talent that they can actually build around. It's not like they've got guys on staggered contracts. Like, they literally got rid of everybody that they had to pay a lot of money to. Yeah. Shabbat is not going to be up for a long time. So like, this is a window where you kind of stock up now.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think they've got the right approach. I just worry about what happens like next year if they look even remotely good.
Speaking of that, what happened with Gustafsson? I thought he was our premier goaltending prospect, and it seems like he's been surpassed by Decord and Hogberg.
Hogberg is 25 years old. Like, he didn't make my little urban achievers team because he's kind of graduated, and that kind of is a humbling moment to say, like, oh, young goaltending prospect Marcus Hogberg, who's 25 years old and was drafted when I don't even know, but I presumably 5 years ago, is like, oh yeah, well, maybe, you know, Gustafsson's not as close as I think he is. But it's, I don't know if anything happened to Gustafsson so much as Decord, who I think at the beginning of the year was playing in the ECHL, is just putting on a show. Like, but the Angel, who runs the Sens Prospects account, weekly posting these incredible saves that Decord is, you know, I think that Gustafsson is doing fine, but Decord is like turning heads when he plays and actually winning games, which I think is, you know, gives you a little extra spice. I found the Hogberg experience so far has been like, man, Hogberg looked absolutely outstanding in this 5-4 loss. You know, like, he just gets peppered and looks really good, but like, you can't make 50 saves a night kind of thing. I'd love to see Hogberg with a better defense in front of him. Also, Hogberg Nielsen, sing that song.
No, but James, you're right. Like, everything is like, and I think you guys had said this on one of your other shows, like, for being, this is as good as a bad season can go, right? Like, they have some good young players. They have a decent, you know, farm system. They have a ton of picks. They have, you know, young guys who look like they're going to be good. Like, Hogberg, like, losing 5-4 most nights in an entertaining game where your team looks competitive is kind of the ideal when you're rebuilding, right? Like, I mean, I just think about, I don't know, like, what was it, 4 years in a row that Edmonton had a first round or first overall pick or top, was it first overall for 4 years in a row? It was, right?
Yeah. And never really made a bad decision. Like, none of those players were like reaches that they took.
No, but, and the thing too was that they didn't have really kind of any system around them, right? Like, I think their best veteran on those teams was like Sam Gagne or something like that. Like, within a couple of years, like, everybody was like, there was no system in place. Nobody was kind of, you know, leading that team. And it never went anywhere, right? So in a way, I kind of like that they have some decent players. They've got a couple guys like Borowiecki who seem to be liked by the other guys and seen as kind of veteran leaders who aren't going to do a ton of damage to the team's kind of long-term cap outlook. The coach seems to be doing his job. The only thing I worry about is that, like, NHL coaches, especially young coaches, seem to have a shelf life. So I kind of feel like, you know, worst case, these guys are like really stocked and ready to compete in like 2 or 3 years. And they're at that point in the cycle where they're like, and none of us are listening to the coach anymore.
Yeah.
But other than that, like, you know, they're as on track as they can be. Now yeah, I'd say it was 2011 where you had a bunch of picks and you had like a young Eric Carlson that you knew was going to be good. Mm-hmm. But even then, like, they didn't have the prospect depth they have now. Yeah. Right? They just, you managed to move forward a little quicker than they expected, sign some free agents, push bad contracts out as far as possible, consolidate debt, and, you know, pick up toxic assets from other teams and contend for as long as possible until it exploded in a completely, when you think about it, a completely hilarious fashion. you know, and that's your 2010s for your Ottawa Senators.
The reviews are in. Team enjoyed by all.